I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate. Over the past six decades, more than 200,000 Korean children have been adopted by families abroad. Today, some of those children are returning to South Korea in a quest to reconnect with their culture and, in some cases, their birth families. Maggie Jones chronicles the lives of Korean adoptees who've returned to their birth country and her experience as a parent of an internationally adopted child in the most recent issue of the New York Times Magazine. We have a link to that article on our show page at WNYC.org, and I'm pleased it brings Maggie Jones to the Leonard Lopate Show. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. The title of your piece calls this A Generation of Korean Adoptees Who Are Returning Home. How did you discover this community of adoptees who grew up in the United States and are now going back to South Korea?
Well, I can't remember the exact link where I started reading about it, but because I'm an adoptive parent, I read a lot about adoption, and I read a lot from adoptees' perspectives. So I think I had come across small piece mentioning the activism that was going on in Seoul with Korean adoptees, and it just sounded like a really fabulous story to think about these kids who had grown up in the United States who were returning, you know, not for the summer, but to live for years and be involved in politics and in the community.
How large is this community?
No one has really firm numbers because, you know, not every adoptee who moves there is reporting into anybody, but GOAL, which is an organization, the largest adoptee organization in Seoul, has tried to keep track, and they give a rough estimate of 300 to 500.
And of those that you spoke to, what was the most common reason that you heard for why they had returned to live in South Korea?
I think very broadly, it's some sense of wanting more connection to this country that they came from. You know, some had lived there for several years. Some were babies when they left with no memories whatsoever. But that connection may be in the form of wanting to initially search for a birth family, or they already know who their birth family is and want to be closer to them, to wanting to learn Korean, which is a very difficult language for these adoptees to learn, and they want to do it in an immersive way. And I think the community itself has grown in such a way that this, you know, community of Korean adoptees itself is appealing for many adoptees who haven't really had that in their lives in the United States and Europe.
That sense of connection.
Mm-hmm. That sense of, you know, that they have grown up in, they are Korean by birth. They don't look like their parents. They've often grown up in white communities, and it can feel pretty isolating. And on the flip side, pretty intoxicating to be in the country where you were born, where people look a lot like you, where, and there is also this community of adoptees who have common experiences that they share with you.
Many of the adoptees who you profile are in their 20s and 30s. Let's talk about the context in South Korea when these children were put up for adoption. Why was there an explosion of adoptions in South Korea to the United States?
There was an explosion. I mean, you know, the history starts pretty slowly, as, you know, it often does in countries where there's a disaster or something. This is the end of the Korean War, the first small wave of adoptees. But when the explosion really happened was after in the 70s and 80s, when there were two things going on. There were, in the United States, birth control, the pill, was more widely available. Abortion was legalized. Single motherhood was more accepted. So there were fewer babies to adopt domestically. Mm. And in Korea, there is not great acceptance of single motherhood. And there was an encouragement by, you know, many people who worked at agencies and in society, too, saying, this is not, if you're a single mom, this is not the way to have a family. Your child is going to suffer. They're going to be stigmatized. They will be better off. You will be doing them a favor by sending them to, you know, white wealthy parents in the United States. And, you know, as I say in my story, by 1984, 1984, 8,800 children from South Korea were sent overseas, which is just a remarkable number. It's one out of 24 kids born that year.
One out of 24 children. What, was there any questioning of that logic at the time in South Korea, and an acknowledgement that so many children were leaving the country?
Yes, there was. There was growing concern. As it grew, so did concern. I think there were social workers who were sort of saying, this doesn't look right. These agencies are not seeming like non-for-profit agencies anymore. And because at the same time, this was not a poor country anymore. It was sort of the 1988 Olympics when the larger world sort of got it. North Korea had been criticizing them. Certain people in South Korea had been criticizing them. But, you know, all of a sudden this was a democracy again, and it was a pretty wealthy country. And what was it doing not supporting its single mothers in order for them to keep their children and raise them where they were born in the families they were born to?
And you write about a moment when Bryant Gumbel referred to the exportation of Korean babies during the 1988 Seoul Olympics. So you see that contrast in their sort of economic emergence and then the continuing of the vast numbers of children who were leaving the country for adoptions. In the United States, South Korea became an attractive country to look to if you were interested in international adoption. Why was that?
I think there are multiple reasons. Generally, though there are exceptions to this, adoptive parents are looking for very young children, and Korea had a very efficient system. So when babies came in, they were processed very quickly. It had a reputation, which, you know, turns out not to be 100% true, as it's not true in any program of international adoption. It had a reputation, though, for being very clean and not having ethical problems. And children were well cared for. They were often in foster homes. And I don't write about this in the piece, but I think race also plays a role in the popularity of Korea. You know, people who there is, you know, still the stereotype of Asian girls, of, you know, being good at math, obedient, easy to raise. And I think that plays a role, even if it's not conscious in some parents' minds, I think that plays a role as well.
Race is something you talk about a lot in your piece, and in particular that many of the now adults that you profiled who have returned to South Korea were raised in white families. And that feeling of, at a certain point as they came of age, realizing they didn't look like their parents and that their parents didn't understand them and their experience of being a person of color, was a big motivator for looking around to in a way to feel more connected.
Yeah, and, you know, I think some of that has changed, but it depends on the family. It depends on where you live. But I think it can be quite, a lot of adoptees have a sort of coming of age, which happens at all different points in their lives, of realizing, oh, I'm not white. You know, I'm really struck by, in one of the studies, about, you know, the high percentage of Korean adoptees who said as a child they felt white or they wanted to be white. I think that's not uncommon now, the feeling for adoptees that they feel white on the inside, and that really influences how they see themselves. And so to that pull to go back to where you don't stand out, where you feel part of the larger Korean community, not to say that it's easy, but I think it is a really key factor in all of this.
For the adoptees who return to South Korea, you know, they don't look apart. They look like this is the place that they come from, but they grew up in the United States. What are some of the obstacles that they've encountered as they realize that while they're of South Korea, they did not grow up in South Korea?
Yeah, it's a really interesting dilemma for a lot of them, because it's not quite the same, but it's not just dissimilar to, you know, being a Korean adoptee growing up in a white community. I mean, these are their people in a way, and yet they weren't brought up with Korean culture. There are, you know, it tends to be a culture that is more sexist, that where, you know, things like women are asked about their marital status in job interviews, that that, you know, the expectation is that you're married at a certain age. And so I think gender is a huge thing for a lot of the female adoptees who return. Not speaking the language that is their language of their birth culture is extraordinarily frustrating for many, many adoptees. And many I spoke to felt like it was something very primal, that they had once, you know, unless they were, you know, tiny infants, they had once had some of this language, and they feel that there's sort of almost an emotional roadblock to trying to learn it again. And certainly not all of these adoptees are going to stay in Korea. It's harder for female adoptees to find male partners because Korean, as they're called, Native Korean men tend to be more traditional than most of these women would want. And so there are lots of sort of hurdles. And there are people who are living there and have been living there a long time who feel like this is home. But lots of adoptees have a more complicated relationship with the country.
Yeah, you quote a woman saying, "I felt my race when I was living in the United States, and now in South Korea I feel my gender in ways that I hadn't before."
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a really interesting, you know, it would be hard to make the choice of which feels better or worse, but there are trade-offs.
We also invite listener calls. We want to hear from you if you have adopted a child internationally, or if you were an international adoptee. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We want to hear your story about navigating these deep cultural questions and questions of identity in your family. And I want to ask you about that, Maggie Jones. One of the other parts of your story is you are writing as a parent who has adopted two children, one domestically and one internationally, both of whom are children of color who are not white. What did it feel like to write this story as a parent and thinking about how your child might feel as she comes of age, thinking about her connection to where she's from?
Well, as a parent, I mean, these issues were not brand new to me. I think the intensity of them was new, but I had, you know, ever since we adopted our first child and before then, but really once we had her in our home, I was reading pretty vociferously and reading what adult adoptees were writing, because we talk about who the experts are, and they're often the social workers and the psychologists, but really the people who have lived this are adult adoptees, and there is no monolithic story from adult adoptees about what it means. But certainly in reporting this, and, you know, I felt they were so generous, the Korean adoptees in Seoul, to let me into their lives, even more so because adoptive parents sometimes give them a very hard time. But some of it's tough to hear. It's tough to hear about the ways that parents have not met their needs, that, you know, that sort of good intentions clearly aren't enough. And I think it's Kim Stoker in the piece who says, you know, you can't entirely know what it's like when your child walks out the front door without you. And, you know, I have heard that for years, and you know, especially now that my children are getting older, I have, you know, an 11-year-old. It is true. You can't control it. I can't control comments that are made to her. I can prepare her, and that's often something that white adoptive parents aren't terrifically good at. You know, black parents tend to be much better at preparing their black children for what the real world is like in terms of racism. But it's certainly, you know, and I didn't go into this knowing that I would definitely write about myself in the story, but it felt necessary in some way to acknowledge it, and to acknowledge that it's a struggle. It's sort of parenting plus if you're going to adopt children, and even more so children of color.
Parenting plus, you say, and you say that the guidance that adopting parents receive about how to acknowledge the difference if you are adopting a child internationally, whether it's appropriate to just sort of assimilate or whether to figure out how to integrate their culture and where they came from, that has changed.
It has changed, and it's changed for the better. You know, what once was the message, you know, in the 50s and 60s of you know, just don't treat them any differently, color, you know, you don't see color. You won't hear that anymore from agencies. However, it doesn't mean that some parents don't do that. And I do feel like agencies honestly don't do enough. There's not enough preparation before parents adopt, and you can't really know it till you're living it. And you find groups. I mean, there are groups all over, but I do think agencies have more of an obligation, because some parents, this isn't what they're suited for. And if you think that race doesn't matter, you're not suited to adopt a kid of color, because it's not, you know, we don't live in a post-racial society.
I'm speaking with New York Times Magazine contributor Maggie Jones about the complications surrounding international adoption. Her article, Why a Generation of Adoptees is Returning to South Korea, appears in this week's edition of the New York Times Magazine. We're taking your calls. If you were adopted from another country, if you were an adopting parent with a child from another country, give us a call at 212-433-9692. We'll talk more with Maggie Jones after the break. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Maggie Jones about her article in the New York Times Magazine called Why a Generation of Adoptees is Returning to South Korea. And as we were speaking about it before the break, Maggie, you talk about race and how it plays out in these families and how that is sort of part of this trend of South Korean adoptees going back to South Korea. But it's also about culture. You have two children who are not white, one again, adopted domestically, one adopted from Guatemala. Is it different in figuring out how to navigate culture and race? Does the international component add another dimension?
Well, I've got culture in both of my children in terms of connecting to their culture of origin, even though my daughter is, my oldest daughter is adopted domestically. She's part Japanese and part African. So, in some ways, though she's not part of the international system, I feel like I have two international children. And it is, you know, what I said before the break about parenting plus, yes, I feel an obligation to connect them with their birth cultures. I've been back with them both to Japan and to Guatemala. And, you know, it's a tricky thing, because you don't want to force feed it. You don't want them to think like this is this awful thing that I have to do to with connecting to a country that I don't care about. But my children, actually, I do follow their lead and also proactively do some things, but they are interested, and they've been interested from a young age. And I do think that, you know, to some extent, every family has to figure it out for themselves. But one thing that Korean adoptees did say to me is, for many, they wish their parents had taken them to Korea earlier. Some went in high school, and they sort of felt like, you know, high school, everything is hard for teenagers in the first place. It has to do with difference. But it felt late for them often. And I think this generation of parents is better about doing those things and opening those worlds up to their children. It's just, you know, no two children are exactly alike about how much they're going to want to follow up on that. But I think we have an obligation to stay connected.
And another theme that came up in your piece when you were talking to these young adults in Korea who were raised in the United States after being adopted from Korea, it wasn't just feeling culturally alienated from where they were from. It was, you also heard about questions about whether my birth family really did want to give me up, whether my birth mother really did want to, or whether there was cultural pressure that felt inappropriate. And that's sort of a mystery that pulled some back.
Yeah, and it's actually a really hard thing to know. I mean, because, you know, again, there's a cultural divide. And for those who find their birth families, you know, some of them told me that untangling the full story of what happened around their relinquishment for adoption wasn't so easy, perhaps because, you know, there's some things that birth families don't want to reveal, or they're ashamed of what they've done. But certainly what a lot of adoptees have come to understand, especially from a certain generation, is actually their parents their mother wasn't a single mother, she was very poor, but she was married, or, you know, the facts that were put in the adoption paperwork don't quite line up. So, you know, they are at times unraveling at least part of the truth, if not the full story, of what were the forces and circumstances behind their adoption. And you can't separate it from a society that's not supporting single mothers enough.
Lisa, in New Jersey, you have adopted 3 children from Korea?
Yes.
How has this conversation sounded to you?
Well, actually, my husband came home yesterday, and he said, you know, I'm very depressed. I read this story, you know, in the New York Times about Korean adoption. So, and I had it, you know, on my to-do list. And then I decided, you know, I don't know if I want to read it. You know, my kids range from 11 to 16, 2 boys and a girl. We have always incorporated Korean culture into their lives since they were young. Cooking, classes, we mixed with other adoptive families. And our kids seem like very happy. But again, everything that your speaker is saying, I've thought about in my mind. And, you know, she's right on target. When you hear that, you know, 300 to 500 kids want to return to Korea, you know, as a parent, I feel, you know, we owe that to them to, you know, let them go and say, hey, you know, you deserve to go to your birth country. But at the same time, it's like you want to protect them from what had happened to them in the past. You just don't know. So it's tough. But, you know, the rules have changed recently regarding adoption. You know, Korea wants to stop adoption. Now they're loosening up again. So it's like there's more kids available. There's more kids in the orphanage. And there's like 2 sides to this. You know, there's something called the baby box where kids get dropped off in the middle of the night into a pastor's house. And, you know, no questions asked. You drop your baby off. And that place has been overflowing. So it's very difficult.
Yeah, it's difficult and complicated because you are providing a safe, loving home for 3 kids while also trying to keep them connected to their culture. But yes, it's complicated. I think that's what Maggie explores in the piece. Thanks for your call, Lisa. And Maggie, the adoptees who've gone back to Korea have also become a political force. What is their campaign? How do they see how they would like adoption to work in Korea?
Well, again, and I want to say this in light of the caller, too. I mean, you know, there is not, even among the adoptees who return to Korea, there is not a monolithic experience. Not everybody is political. And not, I mean, Benjamin Hauser, who is in the story, and Amanda Lovell, and several people are in the story. I don't see their lives as infused with pain, but I do think that they, you know, the longing is there. It is there. I don't think we can protect our children from that, really. I think we have to support them through their pain. But there is, yes, so there is a political movement that is very, it's been incredibly powerful. And what's amazing about it is some of the biggest political characters there are people without citizenship. So though you can get dual citizenship in Korea if you're an adoptee, it's a lot of paperwork, it's a lot of work, and a lot of people just haven't done it. So they actually have influenced adoption law without even being Korean citizens, which says something about the Korean government's willingness to hear these adoptees, which I don't think would play out in some other countries quite so well. But they have tried to decrease the numbers of international adoptions. The Korean government was doing this long before. I mean, they were also, what the adoptees are really also trying to do is to put in safeguards for mothers. They don't feel pressured to relinquish their children, to put in safeguards that allow children to trace their history, which has been a huge problem for adoptees in Korea and everywhere else in the world that are international adoptions, I mean, even in the U.S. If they want to find their birth parents, they're sort of reliant on agencies, some of which have incredibly helpful social workers and others not so much. The baby box that she mentions is incredibly controversial. I mean, there's a question about, does the existence of the baby box actually encourage abandonment? So it's not so black and white about those things. But and the Korean adoptees are influencing, you know, this isn't going to just be about Korea. I mean, it's impossible to say how big this wave of political activism will be, but there are some Chinese adoptees who are really interested in reforms in China and getting things like special visas for adoptees and adoptees in India, and I think it's going to increase in Ethiopia and Guatemala, places where there have been large numbers of adoptees.
Jill in Crawford, New Jersey called in. Jill, you were adopted from South Korea?
Yeah, I was back in 77, so times have obviously changed, but I just wanted to comment that I think a lot of people that have adopted kids from other countries do a really good job in terms of trying to get the kids involved with their culture and touch with other kids that have been adopted from the same country, and my parents did the same. But I also feel like as an adopted child, in a way, I felt very stuck in between, despite the efforts my parents had made. So I don't know. I know I'm a parent now myself, so mm-hmm. I know I would do the same that my parents did as well. But in a way, someone had mentioned that it's so individual, the situation and the child.
And what did you do with that stuck in the middle feeling?
I actually did travel to South Korea, and I actually did go to the agency. I didn't really have any agenda, but they gave me a little bit of additional information, but they didn't have, like, any way for me to be able to find her. That wasn't something that was really an option, but it wasn't something that I was looking to do in the first place. But I did go to South Korea with the intention of, like, yeah, having some sort of connection to that country in some way. And
did you feel
yeah,
it when
experience.
You got there? Did you feel that
yeah,
sense of connection?
Yeah, we got there.
And did it feel like this is a place that I'm from?
A little bit, but again, it's just that whole in-between, because you have it's pretty obvious, even being Korean, being in Korea, that I was not, you know, from that country, native to that country. So I was kind of in between. I mean, I don't speak the language now. Anytime I go anywhere where there's other Asians, I just constantly get the question, oh, where are you from? Do you speak the language? And then it's like when I respond, no, I don't speak it, then it's almost like they turn off the person I'm talking to. So I don't know. It's just this constant struggle. It's not something that affects me on a day-to-day basis, but because I get these questions all the time wherever I go, I am reminded of it pretty frequently.
Jill, thanks so much for your call. So Jill went back to South Korea, but Maggie, I want to ask you about the one woman that you profiled who moved to South Korea and has no relationship at the time with the family that adopted her in the United States, Laura Klunder. What happened in that family?
Oh, well, you know, if you're not in the family, it's awfully hard to really, really know what happens in a family. You know, I think I talked to both Laura and her parents about this, and, you know, it's painful when there are those kinds of rifts in families. And, of course, they happen in families that where there it's not, you know, there's not adoptees in the families. But from Laura's perspective, she felt like, you know, especially as she got older and older, that race was, you know, a key part of her identity and what she experienced in the world, and, you know, had been bullied by a kid for several years in school who said she was she looked like she had fallen in the mud, or called her a black Barbie, or various things. And I think she felt not fully heard by her parents, that, you know, the sort of kids will be kids thing felt disconnected from how she felt. And that only increased as the years went and as she became more aware of her racial identity and felt like her parents were not understanding of its central importance in her life. And, you know, Laura has, I think, a great quote in the story about when we were talking about the study and, you know, the suggestions that adoptees need lived experiences, visiting their countries, attending diverse schools. And what Laura says is, yeah, that's good, but you need parents who can talk about white privilege, who can say, you might experience some of this. I'm sorry, we're in this together. And I think she didn't feel that. And, you know, for another kid in another family, you might muddle through with that. And for them, for her and for her parents, it was a pretty volatile mix. And I think the more she got involved in adoption politics and the more she got involved in issues surrounding racism, she felt like it was too hard on her to be in contact with parents who she saw, again, from her perspective, as writing off her concerns to her having an anger issue. Now, you know, her parents are heartbroken, too. And, you know, I think Laura says it herself. They have good intentions. So I don't think there's a good and evil in that story at all.
And quickly, how many of the adoptees who returned to South Korea to live do you expect will stay permanently?
Oh, boy, it's hard to know. I mean, I met several who, you know, have no intention of leaving. I think a lot will leave when it comes time to having children because it's a competitive, really competitive school system. A lot of women told me they would leave because there just aren't that many male partners for them in Korea. But you know, then there may be another wave.
We'll see. Well, Maggie Jones, thank you for this complicated story about family in the New York Times Magazine this week, why a generation of adoptees is returning to South Korea.
Thank you so much for having me.